Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwen Sheltimer, my co-host Felicity Sidnell-Reed, and our guest this week, writer Sheila Hurley, writing as S.M. Hurley. Each week at this time, we visit with authors, editors, or publishers who have regional or local connections. We hope to find out a little about their lives and what prompts them to write. We give them an opportunity to read some of their work for us, and we're very pleased to welcome Sheila today. Welcome, Sheila.
Hello.
Sheila grew up in Ottawa. Her dad immigrated from Ireland and her mom from Newfoundland, as she liked to say. In truth, she grew up at the cottage on the Rideau Lake system, which her parents bought and built in the early 60s, so it's very much in her bones. It's on the same lake as the Queen's Biology Station. Each summer as a child, she saw adults spending their time pooting about, having a blast. That's how it appeared to her. But of course, they were all doing all manner of research. She thought this wonderful, so off she went to Queen's and did a biology degree, and then a master's in New Brunswick, and then back to Queen's to do a PhD, which got hijacked by her going to law school, which is another story. She's been a small-town lawyer her entire career, over 30 years, in Picton. She's always written, both as a lawyer, but only some of that writing is fiction, and as a writer. Blackwater Bluff is the first novel she's let out of the gate. Along the way, there were children, now two beautiful men, and the vagaries of life, and always the cottage, to which she and her partner will retire in the very near future. Then she hopes to get back to where she started, chasing birds and insects, and writing. So Sheila, why this desire to write fiction?
Well, first let me say thank you to both of you for inviting me here, and also to Janet Kellow, who I think gave you my name, so I'm grateful for that and quite excited to be here. To your question, when I was little, I was really impressed by books. I loved them. They took me places. And I just wanted to do it myself. I wanted to create something. And it became apparent when I was young that this might be the most successful form of creation for me. I remember my mother, when I brought something special from art school back, well, I guess it was just kindergarten. In any event, I brought it home. And my mother, who was actually a quite accomplished visual artist, brought me over to her side of the dining room table, and she said, "Now, Sheila, look at this and look at your daddy." And I looked at both, and I was very pleased with myself. And Mum said she had to tell me that people's arms didn't grow out of their ears. So the fiction is something that I'm actually able to do as a creative outlet, and I just like the challenge of trying to show things. I see something and I try and figure out how to put it into words.
Now, you published short stories before writing your novel, didn't you?
I did, and I do. I still write short stories, yes.
So what do you like about the two forms of storytelling? Do you prefer one over the other?
The short stories are a way for me to explore an idea in a way that a novel is an exploration as well, but it's a little different. I find the short stories I'm writing these days tend to be slightly fantastic. They're not science fiction. Someone said to me that they would find a home in speculative fiction. There, just by way of example, the story that I published in The County Wave, which is a collection of short stories by county writers, is me imagining what it would be like for that 60-something person to wake up in my kindergarten self. And that's not a new idea, but I just wanted to see where it took me. So it's that kind of thing. And so I don't have a preference. They both serve very different purposes for me, and I like them both.
So now you've published Blackwater Bluff, and it's a mystery novel. So why did you choose this particular genre?
I like puzzles. I like mystery novels. To some extent, it's back to the I just want to do it myself, because I like them so much. I might have got that from my mum, too. She was always reading Ruth Rendell or Agatha Christie. So it's a flexible genre. It still has rules and constraints, though, and I like writing within those. So it suits me in terms of what I have to follow as a guideline in writing, and then. But as I say, it's fairly flexible, so I get to muck about within that set of constraints.
Being a lawyer for all these years, you probably have quite a few stories that can be adapted and pulled in, and you'd have a lot of knowledge too. And I think that's reflects in your protagonist, who happens to be a Crown attorney.
Yes.
So maybe tell us a little bit about your main character.
Augie. Someone asked me, is it Augie or Augie? It's Augie, because as you'll find out in the book, it's short for Augusta, not very imaginative. She was born in August, and the book is set in August. nevertheless, Augie is a farmer's daughter, a dairy farmer's daughter. Her parents came to Canada after the Second World War, during the Netherlands-Canada settlement scheme. She's the youngest of four, and she loves the cows, but she loves school better. She's mentored from a very early age by Ruth, the murder victim, Ruth Neal, who is also a lawyer. And as a result of her ongoing and long-term relationship with Ruth, who started out as a backdoor cheese buyer, her mom, Augie's mom, makes cheese, and Ruth comes to the back door and buys cheese and becomes the family lawyer and becomes the family friend, and ultimately sees something in Augie who's a bright young girl. And so Ruth takes her under her wing. Ruth has no children herself, and Augie is influenced greatly by Ruth, and as a result of that relationship sets her path towards becoming a crown attorney.
Well, perhaps you'd like to read to us from Blackwater Bluff.
I'll start with chapter one. It's an edited version. Chapter one is longer than this format allows, so it's not the actual chapter one, but an abridged version of part of chapter one. Augie DeGraff spoke from the lectern, closing in on Daryl Birch's stout, red-faced mother. "Now, Mrs. Birch, you say your son interrupted the 10 o'clock evening news. You told the jury this is the reason you are so certain about the time he got home." Nancy Birch shifted in the witness box, her body pressing against the rail in front of her as she squared to Augie. "That's right, and you know I'm right. I know you got a tape or a DVD or whatever from the TV people, and I was right that it was news about a fire and two people dying, and it was that dark-haired news lady, and she had on a white top." Mrs. Birch flapped a hand at Augie. "That's there in your cop's notes. I told him, and I saw him write it down. The news comes on at 10 at night, and Daryl came in then." "You did say all that, Mrs. Birch," allowed Augie, "and you are right about a DVD." She took her time turning to the next page of her notes, then looked at the witness for a moment before continuing. "In fact, a recording is made every evening, ma'am, and then exactly the same newscast is replayed at 11 p.m., midnight, 1 a.m., and so on. Which one were you actually watching when Daryl came through the door, Mrs. Birch?" Nancy Birch's eyes widened while her fingers whitened around the rail. Her brow furrowed and her jaw muscles bunched as her stare tracked slowly to her son and his lawyer seated at the table beside Augie. The witness did not bring her attention back when the questioning continued. "You see the problem, don't you, Mrs. Birch? You were watching a 24-hour news channel. You had been drinking heavily. I suggest your son interrupted a much later broadcast of the..." Augie was startled by a roar to her left, and as she turned, she saw the defense lawyer being thrust aside by the accused. For an instant, Augie thought Birch was trying to flee the courtroom, but that didn't make sense because Birch was moving away from the exit. She understood she was the target when he came at her and shoved with a force that lifted her right off her feet. She grabbed at the lectern, a flimsy pine board on a slender pedestal, and it joined her in her flight. There wasn't a sound in her head as the carpet came closer and closer during an absurdly protracted hang time. She hit the floor in a tangle of wood and black robes and limbs, and then Birch was bringing his heel down heavily, to great effect. A searing shock through her right ankle sickened Augie. She saw Birch winding up for a kick, but Detective Jeff Cunningham tackled him from the side, and then the court security officer and other latecomers joined the wrestling match. As Augie tried to push away from the grappling bodies, she saw Jeff's elbows mashing Birch's face into the carpet, his thick lips twisting, his nose bent sideways. The senior court clerk worked at getting his hands under Augie's arms to help her to a sitting position, but her heavy robes, tight underneath her, made this difficult. He pulled her up at the shoulders, and with his help and her good leg providing leverage, Augie inched away from the melee at the council tables, her mangled ankle dragging the foot at an improbable angle. Her lips drew back from teeth clamped against the urge to throw up. When her shoulder touched the wall of the judge's dais, she leaned back and closed her eyes. Sounds began to separate. Someone alternately sobbing and screaming, "Don't hurt him!" The mother. Another voice shouting something about calling 911. Someone else, tightly, "Just stop, you stupid..." Augie opened her eyes. It was Jeff, growling the words, still grinding with his elbow while Birch boiled. She watched the officers, with only one set of handcuffs among them, struggling to link Birch's right arm across his back to his left ankle. A short click, and the cuffs were on, a half hogtie that stopped the frenzy. He flailed and strained on the floor as the officers stood away from him, straightening ties and adjusting trousers. One of them was holding Birch's boots, gray weapons with treads like a crocodile's back. Augie could hear sirens approaching from a distance, the difference between the ambulance Doppler and squad car wails intensifying. "You'll be okay, you'll be fine," repeated the clerk, sitting beside Augie and stroking her arm and sweating. Fighting nausea, she thought it unwise to open her mouth. In her head, words formed. "Oh, God. My ankle looks strange. Jury will be dismissed." She was shocked at her paralysis. She was fit and trim. When she imagined situations of imminent danger, she was confident she could escape the collapsing building or dodge the falling tree. Faced with the seismic disturbance that was Daryl Birch, she was just a statue waiting to be knocked over.
We've been chatting with Sheila Hurley, a mystery novelist, and now we'll take a short break.